down, he wrote. A reasonable sum will, I think, help slow him down, whereas large, indeed justified sums may egg him on even more. While the CIA would build up Tolkachev's account, we do think your final figure of $3,200,000 is high. Soon after writing this, Hathaway told Gerber he would go to the CIA director with a plan to pay Tolkachev $200,000 for his work through 1979, $300,000 for 1980, $400,000 for 1981, and $500,000 for every year thereafter. It would be, he said, the highest salary ever paid to any single individual in the history of this organization. Once again, Turner put on the brakes. On May 10, 1980, he approved a pared-down package, $200,000 for 1979, and $300,000 for every year after. Hathaway told Gerber and Gilshier that he was sure they would be disappointed. "I share your disappointment," he said, "but it is an enormous amount of money." He expressed confidence that Gilshier could use his persuasive talents and his special relationship with C.K. Sphere to get this across. Another factor crowding in on Gilshier was exfiltration. Tolkachev had earlier said he would never consider leaving the Soviet Union. But in his February ops note, he suddenly expressed interest in the idea. "I never thought about the possibility of exiting the USSR," he said. "But if a realistic possibility exists for exfiltrating me and my family, then, no matter what the inherent risk connected with it, I would like to take advantage of this possibility. My family does not know about my activity." Tolkachev asked for more details. How long would they have to prepare? Gilshier felt this new interest in exfiltration was a signal that Tolkachev was growing pessimistic about his future in Moscow. Perhaps if the CIA gave a positive nod to exfiltration, Gilshier thought, it would ease Tolkachev's demands for millions of dollars. At headquarters in May 1980, Turner approved giving Tolkachev the commitment to exfiltrate him, his wife and son, if and when circumstances dictate, with resettlement in the West. Gilshier began to draft the ops note he would give Tolkachev at their next meeting. He knew that Tolkachev had been shattered by the decision on the L-pill. Now he had to talk Tolkachev through more unpleasant news. Gilshier had absolutely no doubt that Tolkachev would be highly shocked and unhappy with the pay package. Gilshier tried to break the news gently. "The evaluation of your materials is very high, and it has been decided to grant you the highest salary that our organization has ever paid," Gilshier wrote, laying out the sums that Turner had approved. There were a lot of zeros, but not millions. Gilshier wanted to cushion the blow by promising exfiltration, but that was also problematic. By merely discussing it, they would raise Tolkachev's expectations for departure. The CIA did not want to exfiltrate Tolkachev unless there was an emergency. They wanted a productive, deeply embedded agent like Tolkachev to remain in place as long as possible. Gilshier didn't promise anything swift. He reminded Tolkachev that he would have to tell his family about exfiltration, and if they were to hesitate, problems may arise. He outlined for Tolkachev what the CIA would do for him in terms of resettlement in the United States. The Tolkachev operation was now growing quite complex. The issues of exfiltration, money, photography, security, and the suicide pill were all interlocked. The Moscow station and headquarters chewed over each of them in detail, with cables back and forth, but every move had the potential for error and to upset Tolkachev, as happened with the suicide pill. The CIA had attempted to manage Tolkachev through carefully calibrated offers of money and exfiltration. But looming over it all was the reality that Tolkachev did not always listen to his handlers. He had an unshakable determination to steal as many secrets as he could. He did not want to be slowed down. Tensions between the Soviet Union and the West deepened considerably in the spring of 1980. The United States boycotted the Moscow Summer Olympics in response to the invasion of Afghanistan, sharply offending the Soviet leadership. When the dissident physicist Andrei Sakharov spoke out against the invasion, he was detained and exiled to Gorky. The Olympics were scheduled to open in July, and for weeks beforehand, the streets were crawling with extra militiamen, many of them brought to Moscow from the provinces. All this made John Gilscher's next move even more risky and intricate. On the evening of May 12th, Gilscher put on a disguise. It was his first experience with a procedure known as identity transfer, a trick that played on a KGB weakness. Although the KGB scrutinized all Americans in Moscow, they could not surveil them all, so they ignored many who were considered ordinary workers, not involved in intelligence. A CIA officer could disguise himself as one of the embassy workers the KGB had ignored and slip out of the compound without attracting attention. The trick worked. Gilscher escaped the compound without the KGB spotting him. He was hoping to make an impromptu call to Tolkachev, followed by a meeting on the street. But when Gilscher called, he heard a voice that was not Tolkachev's and aborted the attempt. The next attempt to avoid the KGB was an elaborate ruse. Gilscher notified the Soviet authorities that he planned a short trip abroad. He flew out of Moscow as planned, but then he abruptly returned, earlier than he had notified them. He hoped to meet Tolkachev before the KGB realized he was back. But when Gilscher got to passport control on his premature return, he noticed special attention was being paid to him, and he decided not to go ahead with the meeting. Two missed meetings and blanket surveillance on the streets did not deter Gerber. He wrote a cable to Hathaway after Gilscher's second attempt failed on May 21st. Although not optimistic about a natural break in surveillance, Gerber said it was essential for Gilscher to meet with Tolkachev once more. Gilscher was due to end his Moscow tour that summer. With the delicate issues of money and exfiltration, Gerber cabled, "We prefer have CK Sphere discuss these critical matters with familiar face rather with total stranger in fall." Although Gerber believed that the station's case officers should be interchangeable in operations, Gilscher was the only case officer he could send now, the only one known to Tolkachev. The two failed attempts to meet with Tolkachev in May led to an important new dimension in the operation. The CIA's prowess with technology was growing, and it dreamed of using electronics to evade the KGB and carry out espionage unfettered. Through the 1960s, communications with agents in hostile areas were largely carried out with a small number of proven techniques, like secret writing, microdots, radio broadcasts, and dead drops. But starting with the 1970s, thanks to the revolution in microelectronics, technology began to transform the way case officers communicated with their agents, and the CIA attempted to maintain a cutting edge. An example of this was the first in a family of small electronic devices known as the SRAC, for Short Range Agent Communications. An early version of the device, called Buster, had been given to Dmitry Polyakov, the general in Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, who volunteered in New York in 1961 and was codenamed Top Hat by the FBI. Later, he was run by the CIA in Rangoon and New Delhi, and now was back in Moscow, where he rose to become commander of the GRU Training Academy. The new device, it was hoped, would make it easier for Polyakov to communicate with the CIA and avoid the KGB. The device was a handheld communication system, which consisted of two portable base stations, each about the size of a shoebox, and one agent unit that could be concealed in a coat pocket. With a tiny keyboard 1.5 inches square, the agent would first convert a text message into a cipher code, then peck the code into the tiny keypad. Once the data were loaded, Buster could hold 1,500 characters. The agent would go somewhere within 1,000 feet of the base station and press a send button. The base station could be moved around, placed in an apartment window or a car. The agent would have to be told approximately where. In essence, Buster was a primitive text messaging system. Its advantage was safety. The agent could communicate without actually meeting a case officer on the street. However, there were problems with using such equipment in the field. Buster was clearly spy equipment and would fatally compromise an agent if caught with it. Hathaway, now division chief, was a technology enthusiast, eager to deploy new gadgets to frustrate KGB surveillance. Ideally, Buster could ease the risk of personal meetings with an agent in parks and on dark street corners. "Think of how we'll save this poor bastard from the danger of going out and meeting somebody from the agency," Hathaway said, a reference not only to Tolkachev, but to any CIA agent who could make good use of the gadget. Over time, Buster underwent major improvements. The next model was called Discus. It was also handheld, but much easier for the agent and the case officer to use. The Discus eliminated the need for the bulky base station and could transmit to a case officer holding a second small unit several hundred meters away. Most significantly, Buster had required the agent to encrypt his message by converting it to cipher code, painstakingly by hand, before typing into the device, while Discus used automatic encryption. The keyboard was larger, and it could transmit significantly more data. Moreover, Discus had a verification system, so the agent knew the message had been received. The Discus was way ahead of its time. There were no consumer handheld devices available then, nothing remotely like the BlackBerry or the iPhone. In June, Hathaway urged the station to consider giving a Discus unit to Tolkachev. He said Tolkachev could use the device to signal the CIA when he was available for a meeting, and perhaps select important portions of documents and transmit them to us. He speculated that Tolkachev could use Discus to alert the Moscow station about where to pick up film and other materials in a dead drop. Hathaway expressed confidence that Discus would enhance security and production of this operation. The Discus beckoned as a kind of invulnerable magic carpet that would soar over the heads of the KGB. While the traditional method of dead drops usually took a day or longer to signal, emplace, and collect, the electronic communicator could transmit urgent intelligence almost instantly. Gerber, however, thought the Discus was ill-suited for Tolkachev. He had experimented with the device and knew that operating it was far more complicated than just pressing a button. He tested the Discus in a Moscow vegetable market while looking over cucumbers and tomatoes as his wife Rosalie held the second unit in another section of the market. For an exchange, the Discus required both sender and receiver to be static. Gerber tried to send a signal. He immediately realized that an agent would have to be looking down into his pocket until the red verification light flashed, or else he would not know the message went through. The red light flashed only after a pause. Was peering into one's pocket, watching for the light to flash, the kind of body language that would give away an agent? Was it worth the risk? Moreover, Gerber surmised that the agent would have to give some kind of warning to the CIA that he was about to transmit on Discus. That signal was another operational act. Also, sites had to be selected and tested in advance for Discus transmissions. The radio waves tended to bounce around, and not all locations were suitable. What's more, the testing also put the signal in the air, briefly, where the KGB might notice, and it required case officers to be exposed. Was it worth the risk? Gerber doubted that Discus could ease the security dangers for Tolkachev, and thought it might bring new ones. "Do not think now is the time to discuss topic with him," Gerber responded to Hathaway. He added, "The value of CK's fear production is in voluminous reproduction of entire detailed documents, not just in few tidbits, that could be transmitted by discus. Gerber insisted that they continue personal meetings for the large amount of material Tolkachev was delivering. Gerber wanted a sure, steady process. He said that giving Tolkachev a discus might spur him to speed up and take risks. He also pointed out that Tolkachev's own preference was for meetings, not dead drops. Tolkachev has strong psychological need for direct personal contact. On June 11th, Gerber sent a second strong cable to Hathaway, saying he had raised using the discus with the case officers at the Moscow station. "We conclude that in this operation, we have more to lose than to gain," he wrote. The device wasn't very useful in sending or receiving complex messages, such as those concerning requirements or what secret materials Tolkachev might gather. Moreover, the discus would bring Tolkachev and CIA case officers into frequent and close proximity to each other on the street, which the KGB might notice as a pattern. To evade the KGB, different sites would have to be selected for every transmission. It just wasn't worth it. Gerber thought to himself that perhaps Turner would like to eliminate human intelligence and just rely on technology. But it could not be done. They needed to look the agent in the eye, and Tolkachev needed to shake the hand of a case officer he could trust. Chapter 9. The Billion-Dollar Spy. On June 17, 1980, Gilshear put on a disguise once again and headed out to the street. The KGB watchers didn't see him. The disguise worked exactly as intended. After a surveillance detection run, he met Tolkachev at 10:55 p.m. for their seventh rendezvous. The sky was luminescent. In good spirits, Tolkachev told Gilshear he had not encountered any difficulties. He was relieved they could meet before his summer vacation because he had been very busy. He had good news. In February, the tightened security arrangements had suddenly been abandoned. Once again, it was no longer necessary to deposit the building pass when checking out documents. The reason was a bureaucratic logjam. The clerks in the department, mostly women, were swamped with all the building passes coming in and could not get out for lunchtime, a break when they usually searched for food and goods. So the director of the institute went back to the old rules. Documents could be taken in the morning and brought back in the late afternoon. Ever zealous, Tolkachev took advantage when the gap in the cordon opened up. From February to June, he brought thousands of pages of secret documents home to photograph with the Pentax. He told Gilshear that he had 179 rolls of film in his briefcase. But Gilshear didn't seem to be carrying anything to take it away. Gilshear said he had a plastic bag, which he pulled out of his pocket. Tolkachev shook his head. The film just wouldn't fit. Tolkachev handed Gilshear his personal briefcase, laden with the 35mm cassettes. "Take the whole thing," he insisted. Gilshear handed Tolkachev the CIA's new, improved Tropel cameras, saying the agency was hopeful they would make it possible to photograph documents in low light, perhaps in his office. But right away, Tolkachev waved him off. He told Gilshear that it was just not possible to use the miniature Tropel cameras at work. There wasn't enough time, either at the start of office hours or at closing, when other people would not be around. He gave the older Tropels back to Gilshear and didn't want the new ones. He seemed to have hit his stride with the Pentax 35mm camera. Gilshear told headquarters that the Pentax permits voluminous photography, far more than using the Tropels. The Pentax had become Tolkachev's most fearsome weapon in his effort to inflict damage on the Soviet Union. Gilshear briefly sketched out the CIA's latest offer to compensate Tolkachev. He emphasized that the proposed salary was higher than that of the President of the United States. He reminded Tolkachev that the CIA would have to bear the considerable expense of his resettlement in America if they went ahead with exfiltration. Tolkachev was stone-faced and showed no sign of reaction. Gilcher had seen that face before. It was a bittersweet moment for Gilcher, whose family history had played out on these magical Russian summer evenings. His entire career had been devoted to the Soviet target, listening to tapes from the Berlin Tunnel and debriefing defectors and agents. His gift had been his language skills. Now, with Tolkachev, as a case officer on the street, he had run one of the deepest penetrations of the Soviet Union ever accomplished. As the moment came to say farewell, Gilcher knew he might never see Tolkachev again. They had met each other 18 months earlier on a frigid Moscow street corner. They had only minutes remaining, and both men, reserved and stoic, struggled to find words. Tolkachev asked if Gilcher would return to Moscow. Gilcher said there was a limit to good things. It was unlikely he would ever come back. Tolkachev commented that he was reading the dissident books Gilcher had brought him as gifts, slowly, when the conditions were right. They shook hands and exchanged a final farewell. Tolkachev seemed nervous and eager to end the meeting. Gilcher told headquarters the next day, the main reason appeared to be desire to get home at a reasonable hour. It was nearly midnight. The intelligence take from Gilcher's meeting with Tolkachev was massive. The film carried about 6,400 pages of secret documents. Hathaway sent a summary of the latest intelligence to Turner, the CIA director, marked secret/sensitive, which reported, CK's fear was met on 17 June 1980, at which time he delivered 179 rolls of 35mm film of sensitive documentary information on Soviet airborne radars and armament control systems. Specifically, the material includes the first documentation on the technical design characteristics of the new Soviet AWACS. It was C.K. Sphere who first alerted us to the existence of this system and enabled us to locate it in overhead photography. Extensive documentation on a new modification of the MiG-25, the first Soviet aircraft to be equipped with look-down, shoot-down radar. This aircraft, used in conjunction with the AWACS, will effectively extend the Soviet air defense perimeter against NATO aircraft and air-launched cruise missiles. Documentation on several new models of airborne missile systems and technical characteristics of other Soviet fighter and fighter/bomber aircraft to be deployed between now and 1990. Hathaway's memo added, "This volume of documentary intelligence is double the totality of what CK Sphere has delivered in the past 18 months of our relationship." Along with the documents, Tolkachev gave Gilcher a melancholy ops note. He said the permission sheet he had signed to get secret documents was at this point several times longer than that of other workers. As long as the KGB has no suspicion of a leak of information on Soviet radar systems for interceptor aircraft, then my work at NIIR and my permission card may possibly lay quietly. But if a suspicious signal is received from America, he added, my card will undoubtedly be the first one the KGB will pay attention to. He went on, I assume that before asking me why I took out such a large quantity of documents, the KGB will search my apartment. Things I can hide in the apartment from members of my family, I can never hide from the KGB. He was referring to a hiding place for spy gear he had created in his apartment. Then he ramped up his demand for exfiltration. Today, I am turning to you with specific request that my family and I be exfiltrated from the USSR. This is how matters stand. Gilcher's fears had come true. Since the CIA had suggested exfiltration, Tolkachev's hopes for it were soaring. However, Gilcher knew that Tolkachev had said nothing about revealing this momentous step to his family, so perhaps there was still time. Tolkachev said he was under a growing threat, and with his signatures on the permission sheet, my future and be considered to be doomed. He wanted planning for exfiltration to begin as soon as possible. He added, "I understand perfectly well that for you, the exfiltration of my family and me is tantamount to the death of an agent who provides good quality information. Unfortunately, this loss is unavoidable. It is just a question of time. Therefore, your sincere answer on whether you will attempt the exfiltration or will let fate decide this question is very important to me." Tolkachev's ops note was tinged with sadness, suggesting that he felt his end was near. Referring to the next scheduled meeting in the autumn, he said, "If it takes place and I am still functioning, and if I am not discovered by then." Along with the ops note, Tolkachev enclosed a note titled, "To Leadership of the Center," his appeal for the suicide pill. He pointed out that, "My relationship with you developed neither simply nor quickly," recalling the long delays before the CIA would meet with him, and the disagreements over his compensation, and for almost a year and a half, he had been seeking the suicide pill from the CIA, but always with negative results. Tolkachev added that since he began working as a spy, several years had passed. "During this time, despite the fact that there have been many distressing moments for me, I have never deviated from the outlined plan. I am reminding you of all this so that you understand that I have sufficiently strong nerves. I have enough patience and self-control to put off use of the means of suicide until the last minute. I insist that means of suicide be passed to me in the near future, because my security situation must be considered precarious." Besides, Tolkachev reminded the CIA, the reason he checked out so many documents was to answer their questions. He then spelled out details of the traces that remained of his espionage, and said suicide was a way to keep the KGB from uncovering those traces. "Suicide, without any question marks, can protect the work I have begun. That is, can keep secret the volume of my activity and the methods by which I was able to carry out this activity." Gilscher was in the final weeks at the Moscow station, and with Gerber, wrote a lengthy cable to headquarters taking stock of the operation. They could afford to take a breather, because Tolkachev would be out of touch in the summer months on vacation. The cable they sent on June 24th described Tolkachev as under tremendous pressure and strain in a bleak security situation. They outlined the various ways things could unravel. They said, "Leaks at our end pose serious threat and could lead to an investigation that would quickly uncover him. Or a routine check of document sign-out records would also expose him. An alert First Department clerk might notice the large number of records he had signed out, and accidental discovery of Tolkachev's carrying out the documents under his coat, or even a recognition of the pattern in which he went home each day at lunch after checking out documents, could blow the operation, they warned. On top of all these serious factors affecting Tolkachev's security, there are undoubtedly others as well. "We reluctantly conclude there is little we can do," they told headquarters. "We are dealing with driven man, who dedicated to inflict most damage possible on Soviet regime. He will continue to produce, be it from First Department or Secret Library, and will probably not heed our urgings to slow down." In view of the security situation, "Can we realistically expect operation to last several more years?" they asked. They did not think so. They added, "It appears CKS is coming close to fulfilling production plan he proposed to us, and we accepted." Thus, they said, it was critically important to have a clear-cut picture of where we stand on Tolkachev's work so far and what espionage he could carry out in the future. With Tolkachev's pressing for exfiltration, Gilshar asked headquarters what the impact would be if Tolkachev were no longer in Moscow. Would it be a huge loss? Gilshar warned headquarters directly, "The operation cannot continue indefinitely." Gloomy was how Gilshar described Tolkachev's letter seeking the suicide pill. "If uncovered," he warned, "Tolkachev will have unpleasant dealings with security organs and will then certainly be shot. As death in case of compromise is inevitable, CKS should be given choice of using special request and avoiding agony of facing authorities. Having the suicide pill available in case of need would give Tolkachev much-needed psychological and moral support." Gilshar cautioned headquarters yet again that additional delays and rejections of special request will alienate CKS at critical state of operation and could lead to serious handling problems or even end of production. At headquarters, Hathaway was sympathetic. Unlike the last time Turner was asked to approve the suicide pill, when the request was watered down by the acting chief of the division, this time Hathaway didn't mince words. He wrote a strong memo that echoed the thinking of his chief of station and case officer. Providing Tolkachev with the L pill would be a significant psychological boost to him, Hathaway said, describing Tolkachev as a mature, sensible, and cautious individual who needed an escape hatch in case he was arrested by the KGB. In July, Hathaway responded to earlier questions from the Moscow station about the value of Tolkachev's intelligence. He said that even if Tolkachev departed the Soviet Union, the value of his product would not diminish for at least 8 to 10 years. Why? The weapon systems that Tolkachev had already betrayed to the United States were either just becoming operational or on the drawing boards, and they could not be easily replaced. On the other hand, if Tolkachev continued spying in Moscow, the yield could be even greater, as new weapon systems came across his desk year after year. Tolkachev's amazing haul of documents, blueprints, and diagrams was made available in its raw, untranslated form to very few people in Washington. One of them was a special assistant in the Air Force who had used the intelligence to terminate or reorient research and development programs of the U.S. military. Tolkachev was providing a roadmap to the United States for compromising and defeating two critical Soviet weapon systems, the radars on the ground that defended it from attack, and the radars on warplanes that gave it capacity to attack others. This was an incomparable advantage in the Cold War competition. Hathaway had asked the U.S. Air Force to estimate what Tolkachev's intelligence was worth in a broad way. Could they put a dollar amount on how much they had saved in research and development costs? The answer was somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion, Hathaway reported to Gerber. That was before they even looked at the 179 rolls of film delivered to Gilshar in the briefcase. Tolkachev was the billion-dollar spy. Chapter 10. Flight of Utopia. On the day in July 1979 that he arrived in Moscow as a new case officer, David Rolfe took the elevator in the U.S. Embassy to the ninth floor, walked past the Marine Guards, through the Chancery, then down a back stairs to the seventh floor. There, at the landing, the door on the right opened to the embassy political section. On the left, an unmarked door had a cipher lock. Rolfe punched in the code. After the first door, he saw a second one that looked like a bank vault. It had a combination lock, but was open during the day when people were inside. He walked down a short hallway, past the small alcove on the left with the paper shredder. Turning to the right, he grabbed the lever on another door and opened it with the soft whoosh of an airlock. He entered a windowless rectangular box of a room, with a low ceiling, shielded in corrugated metal and isolated from the embassy walls to avoid eavesdropping or penetration. This was the Moscow station. David Rolfe was 31 years old and filled with anticipation. He was beginning his first tour for the CIA, and he yearned for an operation of his own, to get out on the streets and run an agent. At one end of the station, the station chief worked from a cramped office with a desk, a safe, and a small conference table, barely large enough for the case officers to squeeze around. The rest of the station was jammed with their desks, lined up along each side, typewriters, file cabinets, protected by combination locks, and maps of Moscow on the walls. One large map was covered with colored numbered dots to indicate meeting sites, signal sites, dead drop locations, and who was responsible for each. Music drifted from a cassette player. Clipboards held the latest cable traffic. Rolfe was assigned the desk closest to the chief of station's office. Across the room sat Gilscher, who was running the Tolkachev operation. Gilscher always looked dignified and often wore a blazer and tie to work. "Gilscher always looked like a president," recalled one of his colleagues. By contrast, when they weren't working their daytime cover jobs, Rolfe and the younger case officers often showed up in jeans. Rolfe's first impression was that Gilscher was a bit stiff and formal, but any doubts were dispelled when he saw Gilscher at work. He was totally preoccupied with Tolkachev, and often returned from their meetings with a detailed recollection of what Tolkachev had said, despite the distractions, tension, and exhaustion. When Gilscher spoke, Rolfe listened intently. There was much to learn. Rolfe's own journey to the Moscow station had begun as a young boy on the front lines of the Cold War in Europe. When he was 10 years old, he had tagged along with his father, Arthur, a lieutenant colonel who commanded a battalion of the 6th Armored Cavalry responsible for border security in West Germany, where it met Czechoslovakia. Arthur took his son to see a frontier that bristled with hostility, watchtowers, dog patrols, killing zones, and machine gun nests. If a real war ever broke out in Europe, this was the place that would be overrun by invading Warsaw Pact tanks and troops. For Rolfe, the border left a deep impression. The land beyond the fences looked mysterious, and he was intrigued and fearful. Later, when his family returned to the United States, Rolfe studied Russian at the University of Kentucky and was planning to attend graduate school to study Russian history, but the Vietnam War loomed. By lottery number, he was facing the draft, so he enlisted. For his initial training, he selected language study in Russian. Later, he became an officer. More than once, he was shoulder to shoulder with men destined for Vietnam, but he did not go. The army sent him instead to West Berlin as an intelligence case officer. He wore civilian clothes and worked from a small office in the Berlin Brigade, the garrison for occupation forces of the United States. His mission was to take lists of recent refugees who had come over from East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, and knock on their doors, seeking out tidbits of intelligence about the armies of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. It was hard work, often frustrating. "It was really collecting ash and trash," he recalled later. "We were trying to scrape together low-level fragments of tactical information, and when we found someone, and they were willing, then of course the big question was, would you go back for us? Do you want to visit your aunt and uncle in Prague? Would you be willing to drive by the base and take some pictures?" Occasionally they came across a good source, but not for long. The promising cases were quickly transferred to the CIA. The CIA base was in a building close by the Berlin Brigade. All the routine cases, they would say to us, "Good job, keep it up." Then a good one would float to the surface, and they would take it. Even so, Rolfe relished the intelligence work. He had a competitive instinct to crack open secrets in the denied areas of the East, those dark lands he saw beyond the wall. But he concluded that clandestine human intelligence gathering was a backwater in the army and would never make much of a career. He left the military after a few years and returned to the United States for graduate school at Indiana University, to earn a doctorate in Russian history, hoping to become a professor. On closer inspection, this too seemed a dead end. The job market was thin. Out of pragmatic concerns for his family, a second child was on the way, he went to law school instead, thinking it would at least be lucrative. Rolf earned a law degree from Indiana University and began to practice law, but after a year as an attorney, his heart wasn't in it. He felt the pull of those boyhood memories. When he heard a CIA recruiter was coming to a nearby town, he drove there for an interview and filled out the application. Nothing happened for a year. Then suddenly, he was offered a job. He reported to the CIA for training in 1977. It was a time of widespread doubt about America's role in the world, but Rolf shared none of these doubts. He believed deeply in the battle against communism and the struggle to protect freedom, an outlook born not so much from ideology as from his own experience. He knew the Soviet Union, in earlier decades, maintained a vast system of penal colonies populated by tens of thousands of people who were incarcerated for their thoughts and nothing else. He knew well the ugly reality of the Berlin Wall, the dirty plowed strip laden with watchtowers, mines, barbed wire, automatic weapons, electric shock fences, feral dogs, and probing floodlights. The Cold War had to be fought, and Rolf wanted to be a part of it. During his initial training at the CIA, Rolf was asked if he had a preference for where to serve. The CIA was divided into geographic divisions. Many young trainees did not want to go to the Moscow station because it was known as a difficult place to run spies. It was all sticks and bricks, some said disdainfully. Laying down dead drops and impersonal communications, not handling agents eye to eye. But Rolf repeated to anyone who would listen, he wanted the Soviet division. Sometimes the CIA sent young case officers to the Moscow station who had never served abroad with the CIA. That way, the KGB would be less likely to spot them. But at the time, there was only one vacant slot in Moscow, working with a cover in the defense attaché's office. The CIA hesitated. 2 years earlier, the slot was held by a CIA case officer who was ambushed and expelled. If a new man walked in, the KGB might immediately assume he was an intelligence officer. Despite the misgivings, Rolf got the job. He took the basic CIA training course, and then more training for espionage operations in denied areas, practicing how to dodge the relentless surveillance of the KGB. At the time, he learned the Moscow station was carrying out one of the most extraordinary technical operations yet attempted against the Soviet Union. High-resolution imagery from a spy satellite showed that workers were digging a trench and laying a communications line along a country road between the Krasnaya Pakra Nuclear Weapons Research Institute, located at Troitsk, 22 miles southwest of Moscow, and the Defense Ministry in the capital. The CIA planned to put a silent wiretap on the line, an electronic caller that would scoop up the secrets and record them without being detected. The wiretap would be placed in a manhole along the road where the cable was buried. Rolf was assigned to the nascent project while still in training. An exact mock-up of the manhole had been built near Washington, D.C., by a CIA contractor for training. Step one was to pry off the heavy manhole lid. Rolf was instructed how to use a crowbar and hook to remove it. Once he was inside, a case officer's patience and skill would be sorely tested. Trainees had exercised in blindfolds to see if they could enter the manhole and carry out the operation by feel alone. Rolf was thrilled to be selected for the mission. In training one day, he hoisted the heavy manhole cover using the crowbar and hook. Then, suddenly, he dropped it. The manhole cover smashed down on his thumb. Rolf felt a jolt of pain. He turned to his supervisor and tried to seem unperturbed. The supervisor took one glance at his thumb, which was limp, and sent him to the hospital. It was broken. A few days later, wearing a cast, Rolf returned to headquarters. He volunteered to resume the training on the manhole as soon as the cast came off in a few weeks. But his superiors waved him off, saying there wasn't time. They didn't want to delay his arrival in Moscow. Rolf felt angry at himself and sheepish about the accident, but he didn't linger over it. He had been selected for Moscow duty and was proud to be going. He felt like an astronaut chosen for an Apollo mission. Soon, with his cast off and his training complete, he walked into the Moscow station. Rolf arrived as the days of timidity in Moscow, the days when there hadn't been an agent worth the name, were over. The station, once frozen by Turner's stand-down order, was now buzzing with activity. Tolkachev was producing huge volumes of secret documents, and the manhole wiretap was about to be emplaced and connected. Then, just as Rolf found his desk in the station, yet another audacious operation got underway, and he would be part of it. That summer, Viktor Shymov took advantage of the warm evenings to stroll with his wife Olga on the broad avenues of Moscow. Shymov was 33 years old, one of the youngest majors in the KGB. He held an extremely sensitive job in the directorate responsible for the agency's encrypted communications with its stations, each known as a residentura, around the world. Shymov worked in the tower, a building at KGB headquarters that housed the 8th Chief Directorate, located behind the Lubyanka, a foreboding pre-revolutionary stone structure that had come to symbolize the power of the KGB and its Soviet predecessors. Before coming to the KGB, Shymov worked on missile guidance systems. His father was a military engineer, and his mother a doctor. His reputation was that of a young electronics whiz. He had recently been dispatched to China to solve an eavesdropping case that no one else could crack. And he did. But privately, Shymov was seething. It was hard to say when the disenchantment set in. He had been promoted so rapidly that he had never acquired the blithe passivity of the older generation. He was young enough to be offended when things weren't right. Early in his days at the KGB, he had been assigned to a secret unit that prepared briefings and analysis for the Politburo. The briefings were altered to meet specific orders and were full of deceptions and fabrications. Shymov was appalled. He saw a chasm between the reports to the bosses and the reality on the streets. One day he went to the KGB library and asked the woman at the desk if he could read a history of the Communist Party. He saw himself as a scientist, an engineer, someone who respected facts. Maybe he could find answers to his questions in such a book. Everyone who had a college education had to take a course on the history of the party. What could be more loyal than a curiosity about the history of the party? The librarian asked him for his identification card, perhaps intending to report him to superiors. He could see it on her face. Why would anybody be reading such a thing? Shymov played it cool, pretended to be interested in another book, and walked out as soon as he could. Then a friend in the KGB named Valentin died suddenly and mysteriously. Valentin had been youthful and healthy, a cross-country skier. His father was a member of the Central Committee. But Valentin was a nonconformist type, telling Shymov that he despised his father and the party hierarchy. He had called them a disgusting gang in the presence of his father. After the death, Shymov discovered that his friend was probably murdered by thugs from the KGB. At Valentine's funeral, he stood over the casket and silently vowed to exact revenge. In the months that followed, Shymov pondered what to do. He was more and more disillusioned. It was fashionable among younger people at the time to be cynical about the system, to affect Western dress and culture, and to make wicked jokes about Brezhnev and the aging, dysfunctional party leadership. But most people just talked in private. They did not act on their thoughts. In 1979, Shaimov decided to act. He started to plan for an escape. He was determined to strike a blow at the system, a damaging blow. Olga was frightened. Their daughter Yelena had just turned 4 years old, but she vowed to stick by him. At first, Shaimov hatched a plan to contact an American intelligence officer. Shaimov had never been to the United States and harbored no illusions. He knew from reading secret cables that the United States was the enemy, and his logic was simple. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. He wanted to take his revenge by going to America. He knew it would be risky. He possessed a top-secret security clearance. If discovered, he would be immediately arrested and probably executed. Yet Shaimov was streetwise about Moscow, an intelligence officer trained to move about without being detected. He devoted hours to searching for a car with the license plates of an American diplomat. But Shaimov could not find a car with D-04 plates. He then decided to write a note in case he encountered an American intelligence officer. "Hello," it began. "I am a KGB officer with access to highly sensitive information." He hinted that his dissatisfaction with the system demanded action and proposed a meeting at a tobacco kiosk near a Moscow metro station. But Shaimov could not find anyone to give the note to. One night, he confessed to Olga that four of his ideas for contacting the Americans had all come to nothing. He had even concocted a reason to visit the foreign ministry for a meeting, thinking he might find the car of an American diplomat there. He planned to bump into the American car with his own, creating a small fender bender incident at which he could leap out and give the driver his note. At one point, Shaimov spotted an American car, but when he tried to scrape it, the driver pulled away just in time. The note was in Shaimov's palm that day, but never delivered. Finally, Shaimov came up with a far more ambitious plan. In October 1979, he was on a business trip to straighten out embassy communications in Warsaw. He had brought his father's thick eyeglasses and stopped at an optician, asking if he could get them repaired. That was a nice little cover story. The eyeglasses had another purpose. One afternoon, he went to see a movie with some KGB colleagues. He excused himself just as the film was starting and caught a taxi to the American embassy. His plan was to walk up to the door of the embassy wearing the glasses as a disguise. But he had made one mistake. It turned out that his father's eyeglasses were so thick, he couldn't see a thing. Nearly blind, but undaunted, he stumbled toward the Marine guard and said, "I need to speak to the representative of American intelligence." The guard looked at him and replied, "I am the representative of American intelligence." Shaimov responded with a backup line he had memorized. "Then I need to speak to duty diplomat." Soon, Shaimov was face to face with the Americans, took off the glasses, and told them he wanted political asylum in the United States. He wrote on a piece of paper, "KGB." They escorted him to a windowless room. The conversation was stilted. The American spoke Polish, but not Russian. Shaimov had just fragments of English. They photocopied his passport and asked him a few questions, such as who was the KGB chief in Warsaw. Shaimov's answer satisfied them. He was indeed a KGB officer. "What's your line of work?" one of the Americans asked. "Cipher communications," Shaimov said. The Americans looked at each other with surprise. "Are you a cipher clerk?" one of them asked. "No, I am responsible for the security of the KGB cipher communications abroad," he replied. The Americans were dumbstruck. A man with the keys to the kingdom, the ultra-secret codes to Soviet communications, was volunteering to defect. They asked if he wanted to be whisked out of Warsaw immediately. "No," Shaimov replied. he wanted to bring his wife and daughter to the United States. He told the Americans he would soon be returning to Moscow. They told him he was crazy, but he insisted. On a sheet of paper, he wrote his proposal for a rendezvous early in 1980, and he handed it to one of them. The CIA then set up a plan to communicate with Shymov in Moscow. He gave them an address that was not his own. He was told to expect a letter by regular mail. If anyone opened it, the letter would appear to be from an old friend, someone with an innocuous name, say Smirnov, recalling a training exercise years before. When he got the letter, they said, he should wet it down, and invisible writing would appear on the other side with instructions for how to signal he was ready to meet the CIA. As they walked out, one of the Americans asked Shymov if he had ever heard of Halloween. "No," he said. "What's that?" The American explained it was a holiday, taking place that very evening. "You pulled one hell of a trick-or-treat," he said. "I'm sorry," Shymov replied. "Oh, never mind. You'll find out." They put him in a car and dropped him at the movie house 10 minutes before the film was to end. When the Moscow station got word of the Shymov case, Hathaway was finishing his tour. He had to make a decision. Who would handle the new agent? He could not give the case to Gilshar, who was busy running Tolkachev. His other senior case officer, James Olson, would be valuable, but was deeply involved in the sensitive manhole operation. There were a few other possibilities. All skilled case officers, but without polished Russian language skills. Hathaway gave the case to David Rolfe, the new arrival, who spoke Russian well and was eager to show what he could do. A code word for Shymov was sent from headquarters to the Moscow station. CK Utopia. The code name suggested sky-high expectations, yet much about Shymov was entirely unknown. Did he really serve as a master of KGB overseas communications? How could they check? How could they get a peek at the kind of intelligence he would produce? What did he want? The Gerber rules, fashioned 9 years earlier, still mattered. Shymov wanted exfiltration with his family. There were files in the station with the code word CKGO, containing scenarios for getting an agent out of the country. But the Moscow station had no experience. It had never been done from the Soviet Union. A KGB man with such top-secret clearances couldn't just go to the airport and fly away. Travel abroad was tightly controlled for all Soviet citizens. Moreover, Shymov might have been subject to KGB counterintelligence surveillance in Moscow. If there were any suspicions, he would be arrested. Rolfe made a rather unconventional suggestion to Hathaway. He said they should give Shymov a pair of new Tropel cameras in one of the first meetings. They could ask Shymov to photograph the most sensitive documents on his desk and then return the cameras. When they developed the film, they would see whether he had the access that he claimed, and whether it was worth it to take him and his family out. Immediately, headquarters objected to giving the cameras to a completely unknown and untested agent. What if he was a dangle? What if he delivered the precious technology right into the hands of the KGB? And what if he got caught with the cameras? But Hathaway liked the idea and backed up Rolfe. At one point, he wrote a stern cable to headquarters saying that he, Rolfe, and all the other case officers in the station thought it was a good idea to give Tropel cameras to the new agent. Could they all be wrong? Headquarters relented. The Tropels would be shipped out soon. As Gerber arrived in January to take over as chief, the Moscow station mailed the letter to Shymov with the invisible writing. The signal, the letter explained, was to be made on a Sunday at a location that the CIA had given the codename Bulochnaya, or Bakery. Every Sunday, Rolfe drove to church services, a route that took him past the site. He kept an eye on a concrete pillar at one corner of an apartment complex. Then, on a Sunday in late February, He spotted the black V drawn by hand. Everyone on the street was walking by as if it meant nothing, but it was the signal from Shymov. They would meet soon. Before